Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Stephen Greenblatt, the award-winning Shakespeare scholar, has looked once more at these works which have inspired him during a time that concerns him. His new book is called simply Tyrant, Shakespeare on Politics. As an aging, tenacious Elizabeth I clung to power, a talented playwright probed the social causes, the psychological roots, and the twisted consequences of tyranny. In exploring the psyche and psychoses of the likes of Richard III, Macbeth, Lear, Coriolanus, and the societies they rule over, Stephen Greenblatt illuminates the ways in which William Shakespeare delved into the lust for absolute power and the catastrophic consequences of its execution. The name again of the book is Tyrant, Shakespeare on Politics. It is a great pleasure to welcome Stephen Greenblatt to this week's book show. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
This is an interesting project, and I'm wondering at what point it came to you. I have an idea when it came to you, but I'm wondering for you when it came to you.
Well, in some ways, it's always been with me. That is to say, I've been thinking about Shakespeare much of my adult life. And then pieces of this project came to me at different moments, actually a fairly long time ago. Back in the 1980s, I went to what was then the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, to go to a Shakespeare event. The Germans love Shakespeare. And I remember seeing a performance of Hamlet at the theater in Weimar where this event was taking place. And there's a tiny moment in Hamlet in which one of the minor characters asks for permission to go back from Denmark to Paris. And in this production, there was a little bit of stage business, which was that the king went over to a huge desk, took out a passport, and gave it to the young man, character called Laertes, and the entire audience gasped. So I thought, gasp? What's going on? And then it took me a second to realize that, of course, they can't get passports from the GDR to go to the West, that what they were watching was charged with their own contemporary events, even though it was also a piece of business in the play itself. And I realized forcefully then, as I've realized on many other occasions, that Shakespeare lives in the past 400 years ago, but he also lives in the present, and that one is going back and forth between the past and the present. So to return to your question, in some sense I've thought about this a lot, but of course in the political turmoil of the last year and a half, I've thought about the force of Shakespeare's vision of politics more intensely than I had ever done before.
What is a good starting definition of tyrant, and how does that differ and compare to perhaps a definition that Shakespeare would have of tyrant?
Well, in Shakespeare's world, the distinction that was made in his time between a tyrant and a legitimate ruler, and of course he lived in a monarchical world largely, it was kings and queens, was that a tyrant ruled over unwilling subjects and a legitimate ruler ruled over willing subjects, that a tyrant ruled for his own pleasure and not for his people, and a legitimate ruler ruled for his people. It was a tremendously charged definition in Shakespeare's time, because if you called a ruler a tyrant, if Shakespeare called Queen Elizabeth or King James a tyrant, he was liable to be charged with treason. It was a crime. In the ancient world, a tyrant was someone who ruled a city-state in Greece, let's say, without the consent of the elite. So a tyrant was a new man who came into power in the state. For us, I suppose tyrant usually implies someone who doesn't care about the rule of law, who doesn't care about legitimacy, who operates simply with his own will and power and the people who support him.
Do you believe it's safe to say that Shakespeare had a fascination with tyrants?
I do, Joe. He had a fascination all his life with how it was possible for whole societies to fall into the hands of disastrous leaders. It was something he thought about in his earliest history plays. It was something he was thinking about in his last tragedy, Coriolanus, and even after that. What happens when a society gets into the wrong hands?
What do we know about how that writing helped him understand it better?
What we know, Joe, is that first and foremost is that it wasn't safe. Not only not safe, it wasn't legal as well as not being safe in Shakespeare's world to talk directly about the events going on all around him. So the condition for whatever Shakespeare did with his plays is that he was living in a world without freedom of speech, without a democratic public sphere, and in which it was unbelievably risky to try to address anything going on directly. And what that meant in his world was that he supremely, but everyone else, also developed very high levels of skill at talking about what most mattered to them, but at an oblique angle, at a distance. It turns out that that skill, which is, this is not the only time in the world it's happened. You could see it happening in the Soviet Union in the 20th century or in China and Iran today. That skill actually also leads into very deep thinking about politics, or it can. So in Shakespeare's case, it's not simply that he had to address everything at an angle, but that he dug deep into the meaning of the political life in his world, and I think in our world as well.
And it seems, I think the word you use is covertly, right? He did it somewhat covertly of commenting on what was happening around him.
Well, it wasn't an accident, Joe, that his plays are located in ancient Rome, ancient Greece, or medieval England 200 years, or 300 or 400 years before his own time. He could never write about contemporary events. In that sense, it was covert, and yet everyone understood what was just behind the curtain that was kept closed. You couldn't tear that curtain open, but everyone knew what was going on behind it. At the same time that these plays were actually also about the past, as best Shakespeare could understand them.
And there were people, there were others who were commenting directly, who were being imprisoned and murdered. So it wasn't that direct.
Well, you could get your ears cut off, you could get your nose slit, or in a worse case, you could get your head chopped off. So yes, you had to be careful.
Give us a sense of, in his writing, of when we start really to see this start to develop in looking at the tyrant.
I think it starts early in Shakespeare's life. He wrote a series of plays very early, possibly among the earliest he ever wrote in his career, called the Henry VI Trilogy. We call them very unimaginatively Henry VI Part 1, Part 2, and Part 3. And they're basically plays, they're hard to do now. They're not often done because, frankly, they're kind of a mess. But they're brilliant in pieces, at least. And they show Shakespeare thinking about what happens when political parties form. In effect, he's doing it around the idea of the War of the Roses. There's the Red Rose and the White Rose Party, and those parties form and they become blocked or impacted. The parties get increasingly hostile to one another. There's no cooperation, even though the state, the health of the country requires cooperation between these conflicting groups, their conflicting elite groups. And then a fairly weak central leader, young King Henry VI. And what Shakespeare believes is that in this situation in which you get critically impacted politics with a lack of cooperation and a weak central leader, all hell breaks loose. And that's what happens in those plays, ultimately a civil war. But through that chaos emerges a very ambitious, unscrupulous, ruthless person who eventually becomes the tyrant in Shakespeare's imagination. And Shakespeare's great, in effect, breakthrough play comes out of this this trilogy, and that's the play called Richard III. That was his first huge success.
One of the things that you explore in the book, because Shakespeare had ways of thinking about this, is what it was about these tyrants that were embraced by the people.
Well, he asks himself, Joe, do people get fooled by the tyrant? And oddly enough, his answer is actually not as much as we think, that people see, in Shakespeare's vision, quite clearly, most people see clearly and early on that the person that they're dealing with is a liar, that he's cruel, that he's a bully, that he's ruthless, that he's massively narcissistically self-interested, and yet they support him. They help him rise to power. And Shakespeare becomes interested in, why should that be? Why should people do something that seems to be so obviously not in their interest to do? And he has a variety of different explanations for why it is that a whole nation could enable someone who really shouldn't be the leader to become the leader.
An especially good question in a democracy.
Well, oddly enough, Shakespeare didn't live, of course, he didn't live in a democracy. He lived in a world of inherited rule, hereditary monarchy. And yet, strangely enough, in this play, Richard III, set back a century or more before Shakespeare wrote it, safely distanced, he imagined that this disastrous ruler would come to power through an election. That's very strange that Shakespeare, who didn't live in an electoral rule system, thought that it's something about the manipulation of the crowd. And of course, Shakespeare himself was in the business of manipulating crowds. Mm. Something about the manipulation of the crowd was crucial to the success of this kind of ruler. So he's interested in fraudulent populism. He's interested in the manipulation of the anxieties, the fears of the populace, fears of a foreign invasion or of a terrorist attack. This was not an unreal fear in his time, because the whole country, all during Shakespeare's career, was anxious about the possibility that there would be a terrorist attack. They were fearful that there was a ruthless religious organization, a group of people who would stop at nothing and who liked to sow mayhem and violence. And they called it the Catholic Church. And the country was on the alert. The Protestant authorities of the country were on the alert against this terrorist organization, which, after all, was not a completely unreasonable fear, because in 1605, in the famous gunpowder plot, a group of Catholic terrorists tried to blow up the Parliament and the King and Queen.
Did he see a way out?
Once it happened, Joe, he didn't think it was going to be easy to get out. So one thing he dwells on is how hard and how painful, how awful it is when this happens. But he did think that there were forms of resistance. At one point, he thought about, in one of his most famous plays, Julius Caesar, was about a way to stop it before it fully happened through assassination. That is to say, what Brutus, Cassius, and the other conspirators do to try to stop Julius Caesar from coming to power as a tyrant is to kill him. But Shakespeare makes it very clear in that play that he believes that this is a disastrous course, that it is likely to lead to the very thing that you most want to prevent, which is finally the political lesson of Julius Caesar. But then he thought of other ways in which it might be possible to stop, or at least to break the course of this disaster. A disaster, by the way, that he thought could happen also when the ruler began to behave irrationally, crazily, even if the ruler was there legitimately. What happens if that person behaves, the leader begins to behave like a crazy person? Mm-hmm. So he explored lots of ways in which you might be able to stand up against such a person. He thought it was difficult and dangerous, but that thinking about yourself as a servant, we would call it a civil servant, but they wouldn't have called it that way, might be one of the roots. And so he depicts, for example, remarkably in King Lear, a servant whose name we never learn, who is watching his master, who is the ruler of the country, torturing a prisoner who is accused of treason. And the servant steps up and says, I've served you all my life, but I've never done you better service than I'm doing now when I tell you to stop. So this servant stands up against his master, the ruler of the country, to stop him from torturing. These were the days, of course, in which Shakespeare wrote at a time in which torture was understood to be a possibility in the state, not something that everyone of right mind would think was a repellent and unacceptable thing to do. So it was an astonishing moment in Shakespeare's time. And Shakespeare shows that servant actually killed for his effort, but not before he actually fatally wounds the ruler. That's not a solution. So what's the solution? Toward the end of his life, Shakespeare returned to this deep problem. And in a play that, again, not that many people know, called Coriolanus, and he imagines again about it having to turn on an election. How can you stop the wrong person from getting elected? And the trouble in that play is that the wrong person, the potential tyrant, is also a military hero. So it's actually, he has a lot of popular support with the gratitude of the crowd. But the way out, Shakespeare thought, was through very ordinary politics, through the political action of very unimpressive but dedicated politicians, self-interested as they are, but also clever enough to figure out how to tell the people that this is not in their interest, to mobilize people to pull back from the disastrous course in which they seem to have been heading. And that is, in a way, Shakespeare's most remarkable attempt to think through how this could possibly be stopped. Just insistence on ordinary legal political procedures.
Stephen Greenblatt is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new book is Tyrant, Shakespeare on Politics. When you mentioned that year and a half, you've been working on this much of your career, but given your expertise in the subject of Shakespeare, and given the experience that we're going through now in this country, did you read things differently? Did you look at things differently?
Yes. We always do, Joe. That is to say, any work of art that is worth our attention, no matter how far away it is, in Shakespeare's case, 400 years, in Homer's case, almost 3,000 years, any work of art that is alive because we bring to it our own world. It doesn't mean that we have to erase whatever is in the past to treat the past as if it were the present. No, we understand that it's in the past. And yet at the same time, we bring our own concerns. So since you ask, yes, I'm concerned that a set of understandings that I and many people had about what constitutes legitimate politics and what constitutes illegitimate politics, about the way lying has consequences or doesn't have consequences, about what kinds of things can be said about our fellow citizens. Those deep concerns in the present, of course, make me look at these works in a different light, because they are a kind of light that shines in a different way on these texts and brings to the surface, brings out, makes more visible things that one might not have noticed before.
You talk about this at the beginning of the book, of addressing the question of how is it possible for a whole country to fall into the hands of a tyrant. We talked about what it was like in Shakespeare's time, but have you come to a good answer of that in our time?
I wish I had, and I look around me in the world, as we all do, and we look at Putin in Russia, we look at Erdogan in Turkey, we look at Orban in Hungary, we look at Duterte in the Philippines. We see that there are winds blowing in the world that seem to be filling the sails of autocrats. I won't speak for a moment about our own political situation, but about a whole world situation. And I would like to say, of course, I have the solution to all of this, but I don't, alas. There's no single solution. But not normalizing what's not normal is the first step. That is, at least I think, in Shakespeare's vision. You don't simply treat this situation, the situation of Richard III or Coriolanus in Shakespeare's case, or Macbeth, as if this was business as usual. It's not business as usual. Something is happening, and you can't simply pretend it's not happening. You have to actually try to get it in focus and come to terms with it. But getting in focus doesn't necessarily mean getting caught up with every single daily headline to get dazzled or confused by the constant disruptions and disorientations of the present. And one of the virtues of Shakespeare, of thinking about Shakespeare at this moment, is to take a look aside, an oblique look, and see what he thought was actually at the heart of the problems that he identifies as the really frightening ones in the political life of a nation.
We're looking at this art from the 1600s. Are we creating art now, in your opinion, and literature that is doing what Shakespeare did in his time?
I hope so. I think so. If you're asking me for a specific equivalent to these extraordinary plays, which are among the greatest, Macbeth, King Lear, and so forth, are among the greatest plays written of the last 2,000 years. I'm not sure I could name them in our present. But I actually do think, I would say, for example, off the top of my head, that a television series, I never expected myself to say this, a television series like The Wire is Shakespearean in its extraordinary grappling with how a whole culture struggles with a profound set of problems that afflict a series of institutions, schools, police forces, the port city, I mean, and so forth and so on in that program. And there are actually, I identify it precisely with our new long form artworks, and I'm happy that I've lived long enough to actually see them come to existence in my life, of these extraordinary works that often go on over weeks and weeks, months, years, in which a series of artists tease out the implications of their story. Breaking Bad would be another example of, I think, remarkable works of art of a deep, sustained character.
As you finish this and you look to whatever the future holds for this country, what do you hope the takeaway is? And what do you hope the takeaway not only of our understanding of a tyrant, but also our understanding of Shakespeare and in our future reading of Shakespeare?
Well, I think in the first place, I guess there is for me a peculiar kind of consolation, one could say a slightly mordant or bitter consolation, but still a consolation in recognizing that whatever we're struggling with in our world now, it's not for the first time. We're not all alone and encountering something that no one has ever thought about and encountered before. And we can look back, in this case, to one of the deepest and most brilliant minds and imaginations of our world to see that actually he's thinking about very, very similar problems and trying to think them through. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing is to heighten our alertness, our sensitivity, our moral awareness, because one of the things that's remarkable in Shakespeare is his way of zeroing in on ordinary people who are faced with moral problems, but have real lives to live and try to live those lives and at the same time keep some kind of ethical relationship to their world. And that Shakespeare should make fantastic entertainment out of that, that he should make it actually fun to think about and watch, is to me a kind of miracle. Part of the pleasure of thinking about our own political dilemmas in this form is to turn some, at least, of my distress and anxiety into pleasure, the pleasure of actually looking at yourself in this peculiar mirror.
Stephen Greenblatt's new book is Tyrant: Shakespeare on Politics. It is published by Norton. Stephen Greenblatt, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Thanks to Paul Ruest and Argo Studios in Manhattan for their production support. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.